Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. My name is Jean-Marc Grodi. I'm host here at EWTN. And we have this great privilege once again to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by T.J. Nielsen. He's a former evangelical. And you can check out some of his work at evangelicalcatholicism.com and bonechurchrevival.com. We'll get into both those later. But T.J., it's great to have you here.
Thanks
on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Came into the church in 2004.
Yep, on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, actually.
Oh, right, wonderful.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Always an honor always interesting to hear these stories, but also to be part of the continuing journey, because sharing your story is part of the continuing journey. So thanks for sharing it with us. Let's go back to the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your background and childhood.
Yeah, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona.
Okay.
So we moved there when I was three from Santa Barbara, California. I was the youngest of four kids. My dad was the principal of a small Christian school, and we grew up in a church. It was a Baptist church that the pastor ended up becoming a PCA, Presbyterian Church for America pastor, so it definitely had that sort of lean.
Okay.
When I tell people in the South where I live now that it was independent Baptist, that has a very different connotation.
Right.
What it means is just it wasn't officially connected with a specific denomination.
Right.
Anyway, that's where I grew up. I have older siblings. I homeschooled. And it's funny, in high school, my senior year, we had this Christian living class. And one of the things that we had to do was we had to give our testimony, like every single person to give their testimony. And I remember freaking out at the time because there is a pressure, I guess, when coming from a Baptist background, evangelical yeah. background, of knowing like, okay, this was like my conversion moment.
Right.
And I'm like, I had no conversion mm-hmm. moment. And I remember thinking about that and even like talking to my mom, and she's like, well, like God brings people to him in two ways. One is either through like dramatically bad things mm-hmm. that happen in their lives, or the other is the total lack of bad things.
Right, right.
And it was one of those things where I'm like, oh, obviously to me, it was the total lack of bad things.
Did you have a prayer life? Did you have a relationship?
No, absolutely. And like, I didn't remember a single time in my life where I did not believe like in the bodily resurrection, that Christ was truly God. Like, all of the basics of Christianity, I don't remember a single time in my life when I was not talking to God and praying, when I wasn't reading the Bible.
Yeah.
Like, it was like there was no moment. I just, and I think it was a testament to my parents that it was just imbued every aspect of our life.
Which is comforting to hear for parents, right? Like, sometimes it does work, right?
Yeah, no, it really does work. Like, and sometimes they don't go astray, and like, they really do believe the things that are there. And it was, I mean, especially as, I mean, having worked in the church for 10 years and having taught marriage preparation, one of the things I always told all the men is like, your kids, they look at what you do.
Yeah.
And it's a testament, especially to my father, like that he was the one that he believed and took it all so seriously that I believed and took it all so seriously. Yeah. So that's sort of the background where I was. And I mean, going all the way through like high school, there was certain things that bothered me. Like I felt like I was like, I believed it all. Like, but my entire childhood all the way through, there was definitely every time we'd go to church, just about, especially when I got to high school, I was very dissatisfied with especially the corporate worship portion, in that I don't know if it was just me and my contrarian nature, but things like praise and worship music really bothered me. I felt like there was a richness that was just utterly lacking. But at the same time, I felt like the intellectual side. So when you talk about like truth, goodness, and beauty, like there was a lot of goodness in like the examples of these good Christian men when I got to high school that were living lives as they should. Like the truth portion as I was like learning was tremendous. So like, especially my junior year of high school, my dad taught a class. It was called Christian Perspectives, but it was basically, it was a logic and sort of Christian worldview class.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so it was like, I always sort of, you could probably watch this, but I was going to say, I always credit him, especially for my conversion, because of the fact it was that class, especially where it was that emphasis of having to have like a consistent worldview. And basically a consistent worldview where you can't separate truth into different buckets of like, here's the sacred truth, here's secular. Like, no, God's truth is in all things. It's something that's received. So it was like learning to combat relativism and all of this together in this logical way while being deeply like biblical as you're doing it, that I feel like laid the intellectual foundation that led towards my converting later.
Right.
But then there, like I said, there was that dissatisfaction of, especially that corporate worship portion, where I remember when I got to my senior year of high school, that there was the next class in the school where there was a great teacher who's the assistant principal of the school, John O'Hare. And it was a Christian living class where it was supposed to be like, okay, you've gotten the intellectual framework. How do you sort of live it out within your life? And we'd go through all sorts of different topics. But one of the things that stuck with me especially was when we got to this portion of like, okay, what is church? And I remember we had to do this exercise. So like, okay, what are the necessary elements for church? And so we were all like writing down things like, well, you have to have a sermon. You have to have all these things. And I remember at the time, like we had to read them all out, that there was one kid who was kind of, it was a little bit odder kid in the class. I remember him saying sacraments. And I literally asking the person next to me, I'm like, what's a sacrament? I've never heard that term in my entire life. So that stuck with me. But I remember like the conclusion of it was as we came up with like, okay, here are the necessary elements. Mm-hmm. Like you could just meet in a park and have those necessary elements. Like,
right.
But that's not intellectually satisfying. Like there's something missing within that.
How did you think, what was your awareness of other Christian denominations and maybe even the Catholic Church at this point in your life? Like, were they wrong? Were they just different ways of approaching the truth?
No, they were wrong.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Because I mean, especially as you get like the intellectual level of a high schooler, mm-hmm. you tend to like to be a little like intellectually superior. So there's a reason why like high schoolers become a little libertarian at times and then also like lean into their Calvinism because it makes you intellectually feel good. But then actually one of my older brothers at that same time, he was a student at Hillsdale College and he converted to Catholicism.
Really? Been a surprise?
Yeah, so it was a total surprise. Wow. But I was a contrarian at the time. So I remember he came home and I had made a giant poster of like where I'd written this three solas, like sola fide, sola gratia, and put it over his bed so that when he came home, like that's what he would be going to sleep with. And actually it was interesting as I ended up going to the same school later.
Yeah.
It was almost like the fact that he became a Catholic was an obstacle, actually. People say, oh, did you become Catholic because your brother did? I'm like, no, it's despite the fact that my brother did.
Right.
Because it was very hard for me to do something that my brother had already done.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, well, what happened next?
So the big thing was going to college. And going to Hillsdale College is why I became Catholic. And the reason why is I remember showing up, and there was multiple people that were immediately, because I guess when my brother converted it, he's a very vocal person. It made a vocal splash, even though there was a lot of people that converted at the school. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of people from the moment I got there, like, oh, you're going to become Catholic like your brother? And I'd be like, no, absolutely not. That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember even my RA, my dorm, who was a Lutheran at the time, who's now my Catholic brother-in-law, him saying, asking the same thing the first day, and I'm like, no, there's no chance ever that that's going to happen. And then I had my first semester, took class just on the Western heritage and started going through Western history. And I studied history in high school, mm-hmm. but there's certain things that get glossed over that you just never learn about.
Yeah.
And especially when we got to the Arian heresy and learned about the first ecumenical council
mm-hmm.
at the Council of Nicaea in 325. And it was like getting hit with an intellectual hammer. Like, I've never heard of any of this, like, in getting smacked with the authority question of the church, like, okay, at the time in 325, even a majority of the bishops in the entire Catholic Church at that point were Arians. They didn't believe that Jesus was fully God.
Yeah.
And yet you have this moment where you have the first calling of an ecumenical council of all the bishops under the authority of the Pope. And if we can't trust that God's going to keep them from error, like, how do I know that I'm not the Arian?
Right.
And anyway, that was probably the number one moment in my entire life that changed the course of everything.
Yeah.
And so it was one of my best friend in college that he was going through a lot of this at the exact same moment. And this started like this firestorm of discussions. It's Stephen Gaetano. So, I mean, we started getting into discussions with all of our friends and stuff about this. And I remember going on an intervarsity retreat right after we got there and talking about this very issue. And we're driving in the car with this girl, and he's next to me in the back seat. And he's like, yeah, so we're all reading the scripture the same way. Like, you say this means this. I say it means this. How do I know I'm not the Arian? And she just, I remember her turning and going like, the Holy Spirit just tells me you're wrong. And I remember him saying, well, I'm pretty sure that's actually your emotions, which didn't go over very well. But anyway, that was like the intellectual point where like, okay, I need to take this seriously.
Yeah.
Like, and so it was at that point where I'm like, okay, I'm going to start looking into some of these other obstacles. Mm-hmm. And because I'd never thought I was going to even really look into the theology of it. I had wanted something a little bit deeper on a liturgical, like church experience. And so the first issue I looked into was that of the real presence. And part of it was because me and my friend Stephen, we had started going to sort of a high church Anglican church because he had grown up in a similar background, but in New Jersey. And his parents actually had been Catholic and then had left the Catholic church. And so he had a little bit of that, but similar background. And we were like, okay, we're both history majors. We love the history. Like, is it possible to have like something a little deeper than we grew up with? So we started going to this Anglican church where they did claim that they believed in the true presence. So being faced with the authority issue, struggling with this, and that was a semester-long struggle for sure. But then the true presence that someone, I don't know if it was my brother or someone gave me the book, The Hidden Manna by James O'Connor, and just reading through that was, one, it was like I had never read scripture before when it came to the Eucharist, but then two, of just realizing like, oh, every single Christian for 1500 years, except for one weird guy in the 800s, believed in the true presence. And not only that, but they were like, when it came to being martyred, and they're like, oh, we're going to kill you because you're a cannibal. And they're like, all right, kill us. Like, you don't die for something unless you truly believe it.
Yeah.
And then also what tied in with that belief in the true presence was what learning about black masses and Satanism, and that the one thing that they need is a consecrated host.
Yeah.
And so that started like, well, maybe there's something a little more there than I realized.
Yeah.
So that was like that first step.
Sure.
But then it was, okay, so I'm like, all right, maybe I can still have this, be Anglican, have beautiful liturgy. There's incense. Like, there's some great stuff. Maybe I can do some intellectual backflips with the authority thing. So I don't have to do what my brother did, etc. But then it was at the same time, sort of one after one, I'm like, okay, I should just keep investigating these different topics, and just to make, because I kind of wanted one that would be a red, like such a red flag that it would stop me from ever having to become Catholic.
Right.
So it was like one after one, and I started listening. I mean, I discovered the EWTN like audio library.
Yeah.
So like, I'm listening to Patrick Madrid, like listening to all these one after another. And they were, this is, I would say, the portion where apologetics is, where it wasn't convincing me to become Catholic, but it was knocking down barriers when I started going through. And then, so it was, okay, one thing after another, but it wasn't quite getting me there. And I would listen to something on like papal authority. I would call and have like an hour-long conversation with my dad about it, back and forth. And it, I would get to the point where I'm like, okay, like, if I believe the authority portion, like, I can accept it. Like, it's not going to be a red flag that just stops everything.
Right.
So that was sort of a journey that was going on, especially in that first semester.
Yeah. What was your dad thinking about these questions you were asking?
He was very patient with me.
Okay.
Good. I think he was getting frustrated as he saw one after another, and he didn't agree. Right. But he was very patient, kind.
Well, I'm sure he certainly instilled in you this truth-seeking element. So I'm sure that that was... He was, again, maybe troubled by some of the conclusions, but certainly seeing you seeking truth and seeking real answers.
Yeah, and I think the fact my brother had gone through and he had seen with my brother that, like, he still truly did have a deep relationship with Jesus Christ. And that, a lot of the fundamentals that he was most concerned about were still there.
Yeah.
So that was happening, but then there was, like, moments, I guess they're beauty moments or emotional moments that happened along the way that draw... like something deeper. And like, so one of them, I mean, a couple of them that were really stick with me, but the one especially is I got invited to my first mass, and it wasn't just like an ordinary mass. It was just one of my suite mates who was a Catholic, and another that couple of guys, they invited me and a few of other friends who weren't Catholic to go to a high Mozart mass in Jackson, Michigan at St. Mary's Star of the Sea. And I remember we went and like, we didn't emotionally know her to like put any of this. We're like, I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. I remember my friend Steven, like he was just blown away and it stuck with him. I mean, 25 years later that there was this family in front of us with these little blonde girls in these veils. And he was like, I kind of want that to be my family. Like, I mean, as we're experiencing this, and actually a crazy story with that was, probably around 10 years ago, I was speaking at a Catholic conference in California and it was at this very fancy, like swanky resort. And my wife was there with me. And the first night when they put us in this room and there's these loud, like people talking outside the windows all night. And we're like, we're going to have to get a new room in the morning. Someone tries to get into our room in the middle of the night. And they're like, that doesn't usually happen at this nice of hotels. So at 8 a.m, we get a new room. And they're like, oh, didn't you ask for a new room last night? And I'm like, nope, didn't do that. Please give us a new room. So go down the hall to the new room. I open the door to the new room and there's someone asleep in the bed. And I like slam the door shut and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is horrifying. So that night the conference opens and you sit at these tables with random people. And I sit next to this guy. It was a priest. And he introduces himself and he's like, hey, I'm Father Timothy Nelson. And I'm like, oh, I'm Timothy Nielsen. And we shake hands. I'm like, isn't that funny? And then he starts telling this story. He's like, it was really weird. He's like, this morning, someone walked in my room while I was still asleep. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, that was me. They got our names mixed up. And so anyway, I asked him where he's from. He's like, oh, I'm the pastor of Stella Maris or St. Mary's Star of the Sea in Jackson, Michigan. So I told him the story, I'm like, of going to my very first mass and it being this touchstone that was so necessary to my conversion. And he's like, I said that mass.
That's amazing.
So with almost the exact same name. So
That's incredible.
So anyway, that touchstone though of that moment, continuing to study these things one after another, then there was like sort of some moments of that, I would say the goodness portion, mm-hmm. where you're having conversations with people all the time, but there was two things that really like goodness as in like fulfilling that purpose in your life that had huge impact in that same semester was one. Was I don't even remember where I got it either. Is I got a copy of George Weigel's Witness to Hope, mm-hmm. and I think I reread the first 100 pages probably like 5 times.
Which that's a
biography of John Paul II.
That's right.
And that the first 100 pages of telling like his story of his life in Poland, I just couldn't stop reading it, and I just read it probably at least 5 times in that semester. Yep. And then I also discovered, when I was going through that EWTN library, I came across this guy named Fulton Sheen, who I'd never heard of before, and discovered the videos of his show. And I think I watched every episode over the course of the semester.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that was a huge portion of the conversion.
Because when you meet them, when you meet a person like John Paul II, St. Pope John Paul II, and I think still blessed or venerable?
I think venerable. Sheen. I can't remember.
He's getting
trying to remember.
He's on his way there, right?
Yeah.
Maybe by the time I'm in this area. Yeah. But when you meet them, whether in real life or through, you know, reading their biography, right, you encounter something that is, again, it goes beyond the intellectual.
Yeah, there's something you want.
There's something incredible there, right? This person who has imitated Christ, who has surrendered their life to Christ, it's palpable, right? Like you know when you encounter somebody like that. Was the concept of the communion of saints and of kind of like looking to such figures, is that sort of a new thing for you, or do you have some of that in your background?
I mean, there is like an informal portion of it within Protestantism, because like Hebrews, the cloud of witnesses, like we're all praying for each other.
Right.
But I wasn't intellectually thinking about it.
Yeah.
It was more like, oh, who's this? I'll watch this one episode. I need to watch another.
Yeah.
I need to watch another. And because there was just something about it that drew me in.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't an anti-portion. But then there was different elements as I was going through that were sort of knocking down these pillars one by one. And I would say it was interesting that all of them, I was looking to see if there was like something that would stop, almost like I knew this was inevitable because of that authority question. Mm-hmm. but rather than looking for like proofs to become a Catholic, I'm like, I felt like I intellectually need to look for the obstacles to see if there's something there.
Yeah.
And because a portion of them, like ultimately a lot of them is like, okay, like you can't proof text it. Mm-hmm. So it's either the authority thing's right or not.
Right.
Where it comes back to time and time again.
Right.
Let's
take a little break there. You know, so again, you've encountered this stuff, truth, goodness, beauty, these different things that, that led you up to the edge there, but let's take a break and we'll come back and hear what pushed you over the edge.
Okay.
You know, the rest of the journey. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of TJ's story. If you go to chnetwork.org, especially if you are someone who is a convert to the Catholic Church, or you're thinking of becoming Catholic, maybe you're asking a lot of these same questions. You're on a lot of these intellectual journeys that TJ has been describing. Again, maybe the truth side in terms of the doctrines and the authority, all those questions, or maybe the encounter with the Mass or the encounter with one of the great saints and heroes of the Church has piqued your interest. We'd love to accompany you on that journey, help answer your questions, and encourage you and pray with you and for you on that journey. So check out chnetwork.org. We have a newsletter, an online community, events, all kinds of things to help you on that journey of faith. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with TJ Nielsen, former evangelical. You know, before we get back to your story, tell us a little bit about evangelicalcatholicism.com, evangelicalcatholicism.com, and the Bone Church Revival.
Okay, yeah. So the Center for Evangelical Catholicism, it's a nonprofit that I run with that I founded with Father J. Scott Newman out of Greenville, South Carolina. And anyway, what the idea behind it is like, St. Dominic was called the evangelical man. It's like spreading the gospel, especially within the church.
Okay.
So, awesome. I mean, we do all sorts of different things, but one of the things that we do is a weekly podcast called Bone Church Revival.
Got it.
And part of that is like trying to look for like this, what Justin Martyr called the seeds of truth within culture. So it's like trying to evangelize by saying like, hey, that thing that you're looking for, here's where it actually is.
Yeah.
But then also leaning into the fact, like, instead of being embarrassed by the fact that Catholicism's weird, let's lean into it. And so that's even where the name for that came from. We're like, what are we going to name this podcast? We're like, well, we have churches made out of bones. And like, that's it. So
nice. Embrace the weirdness.
So I do that with Father Jonathan Duncan.
Awesome. All right. Okay. So that's evangelicalcatholicism.com and the Bone Church Revival podcast. Check those out. All right. Well, let's get back to your story, TJ. Again, we left off. You'd been really walking us through again, truth, beauty, and goodness, these different experiences and this journey you'd been on of asking these questions. I know there's more to tell, but I think, you know, we left off, you know, you particularly had these encounters, literary encounters with St. Pope John Paul II and Archbishop Fulton Sheen. So what happened after that? What was next in the journey?
Yeah. So I guess the next thing that really was like the linchpin of anything else was that I didn't know who he was. I'd never heard of him at the time, but the Catholic Society on campus brought Scott Hahn to come and speak. And somehow me and a couple of my friends got invited to sort of everything. So I went out to dinner with Scott Hahn. Wow. Then we went to a special like Q&A session with him all afternoon and went and listened to him speak that night. And at the end of it, it was one of those things where it wasn't just me. It was my friend Stephen, but then his older brother, Matthew Gaetano, who actually now teaches history at Hillsdale, that as we went through all of this and we're at all of this together, that it was kind of like all of the keys going like into place intellectually, where just everything starts clicking.
Yeah.
And how so is not just like the intellectual arguments, but it's this basic sacramental worldview that I had never actually seen the gospel presented in that way, the scriptures presented in that way, where it's the sacraments are the key. It's the Rosetta Stone of understanding all of it. So where you go back and you're like, I understand salvation history now in a way I never understood it before. Like where you can even see from like those, I mean, the nature of the sacraments of being like participatory and like God using physical things
right.
that we can actually like feel. He lets us participate in his greatest works, knowing that we're only ever going to screw it up. And he uses the way he uses foreshadowing and typology and all of that through everything that it was, like I said, it blew all three of our minds where we walked out and we're like, all right, we have to become Catholic.
Wow.
Like there's no way around this. Now the work has to begin.
Yeah.
So that was, it's not like anything, like that was the deciding point where we knew this had to happen and we had to start studying. And so the three of us, like we started going through topic after another.
Yeah.
And it was, I think it was also providential that even though he hadn't been there, my brother came into town at that week. He was discerning with the diocese at the time. And he invited us. He's like, hey, you guys want to come to Mass on Sunday? Which none of us had. And we went and I never missed a Mass since in 3 years. And it was one of those things where it was like, despite like the beauty in that case,
yeah.
because it went from like, okay, I'm going to this Anglican church where they are doing, there's the smells, the bells, mm-hmm. the music was beautiful. It was in this old wooden chapel that had been like hand carved to like, well, like the Catholic church in Hillsdale, Michigan, it was like one church for the entire county. And yes, you have the college there, but you also, it's an old blue collar like town with the factory that had been turned down, closed down. The wonderful priest who was there at the time, Father Tom Butler, who was this larger than life, like Irishman from rural Texas, who spent the first 10 years of his priesthood as the pastor at an all black parish in Flint, Michigan. And he would lean over the pulpit and like it was, but then the music was the old, like, I mean, the worst music of the 70s. Okay. So it was one of those things where it's like, this isn't drawing me in, the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
But once you can't unring a bell.
Yeah.
So it's like, once you know what you know, it's I can't not be here or else I'm going to go to hell. Because I mean, it would be a rejection at that point. So that was where we were intellectually. And, but it is even there that despite all of that, you like, there's a growing to love like every aspect of that parish.
Right.
And especially like the priest there
yeah.
who would, what he would do was, I mean, he was, like I said, the salty Irishman from rural Texas who probably weighed 400 pounds. And he would do is he would invite all the Catholic men and even some of these non-Catholic men, and he would invite us all to dinner. He would take the ball and only the men, and he would sit there and then he would give us like the frankest, like spiritual direction that Catholic or that college men need to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'd be like one by one, like, how are you doing? Like, and it was like, it was life changing.
Yeah.
Like despite it being like not the rapper
yeah.
that you necessarily think is going to draw you in.
It sort of, it connects me in my mind back to, you know, the notion of the sacramental worldview that, again, God's part of that sacramental worldview is your human nature.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, that there's the intellectual side of things. There's the moral, the will, right? But also this experience of beauty, and God speaks to us through all those. They're all there in the church, and they'll all be fulfilled ultimately in heaven. But along the journey, sometimes God, you know, speaks more to one or the other. And sometimes I think maybe in his providence, he allows one to be taken away to help clarify, right? And that experience, you know, some of the beauty was withdrawn for a moment so that you could really get sure about the truth and the goodness there.
Yeah.
As part of that journey.
No, exactly. Especially that goodness portion.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, and another, the sacramental part that what tied it with it, and you see like hands of providence in like weird ways, like, I mean, within conversions and little things that you didn't necessarily think about, was we got invited to, we would occasionally, because we were a little over an hour from University of Notre Dame. So the library at Hillsdale was very small. Notre Dame's library is very big. So usually around once a semester, make little pilgrimage to the library, visit Touchdown Jesus. We would try to, at the time, or I guess it became more of a tradition, that we try to tie it in with like go to Vespers in the Basilica at Notre Dame while we were there.
Nice.
And so there was like the first moment I ever smelled incense, like truly in my life, was there, where I can still to this moment like smell it, transports you back. But the sacramentality, where it really tied in, was I remember coming out. And this is kind of a weird thing, but I remember coming out of Vespers and this being, seeing this group of habited Franciscan monks smoking cigarettes. And I just remember staring at them and thinking, like, it's all true. Like, the sacramentality of it is all true. Like, and it was, anyway, it was a weird thing, but it was one of those moments where it's like, it hits you, the grace of it.
Yeah.
So what some people might have seen and been an obstacle for them, but like the goodness of like the physical world was like hammered home at that moment.
That's amazing. Yeah. TJ, maybe it's still coming, but how would you say you kind of resolved that? Because again, as you said, the lingering question is just the authority.
Yeah. Right?
Because ultimately, even with all the stuff you're learning about biblical typology and the sacramentality, you could try to find that in a few different, you know, high churches. How did you resolve the authority question?
I resolved it by looking at these examples. I was also at the same time and through a class started doing a paper on St. Catherine of Siena, just as in a history class, and developed like a very deep friendship with her as I was doing it. And it was one of those moments where it was just like, you just have to put your trust, where it's like, okay. And I was also, I mean, reading other things like John Henry Newman and stuff. And there was a passage from I think it was in a letter he had in there, where there was someone who was just like sitting on the fence and he's like, just man up and make a decision. And it was one of those moments where it's like, okay, well, the purpose of all of this is I want to be with God forever, eternity in heaven. Mm-hmm. I see the entire sacramental order.
Yeah.
As like, I mean, we call it the ordinary means of grace, but like, this is the surest way of doing that. And having that deep relationship with God. Mm-hmm. I see the fruit as it's there. Like, it intellectually makes sense. Take a leap of faith and just like put your trust in God. And like, so that was ultimately, that was what it was. And there's been a few moments in my life where I've had like absolute clarity, like this is the thing you need to do.
Right.
And so that was one of the moments where like, if you want to get to heaven, this is the thing you need to do.
Yeah.
I had already done all the reading, like studied the entire catechism, all those things. So I went to the priest and said, like, hey, I'm ready to become Catholic. He's like, oh, you want to sign up for RCA? And like, no, I'm ready to become Catholic. Like, I've already done all that. So that's when he's like, okay, how about the Immaculate Conception? Well, you don't have to wait all the way till Easter. And you're like, great. And then it was nice. They did have an RCA class in the parish, but it was, like I said, it was one parish for the entire county. It was a very different experience. And I knew some people that went through it and they actually found a lot of good fruit in it. But what he did was he basically teamed me up with one of the Catholic professors, John Free. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, you and John, just meet. And when John says you're prepared, you're prepared. And I remember meeting with him like the first week. He's like, hey, let's go through the catechism. I'm like, I've already read all that. And he's like, well, what about this topic? I'm like, oh, yeah, I've already done all that. And so he's like, all right, we're going to totally change this. And we're going to make this like Catholic experience, like abbreviated RCIA when I came back my sophomore year. So he's like, we're going on a pilgrimage. Like, so we'll start with that. And so I remember, I don't even know where it was, in the middle on someone's farm and somewhere rural, they had a replica of the shrine of like the Black Madonna in like Częstochowa. So we went there. He's like, we're going to go on a retreat. And he took a few of us and we went to the Monastery of the Holy Cross in Chicago, in South Chicago. And actually, that's where I ended up doing my first confession there. Wow. He's like, you're going to experience all of the things that you can't read your way into with Catholicism.
Yeah. I mean, confession is a good example of that. It's one thing to read about that on paper, but then to actually do it.
Yeah.
You know, was that something, I mean, it was new to you, but.
No, I mean, and I always, so I taught my parish RCIA for 11 years, and I'd always, when I would get to a lot of different topics, especially when I got to confession, I would always tell them, hey, just so you know, like when you receive your first communion, sometimes people will get like an electric thrill. You probably won't. Like certain people feel things, you probably won't. Mm-hmm. But where you will feel the cathartic experience is your first confession.
Yeah.
Like that will change everything. Yeah. And so anyway, 100%, that was the case.
Yeah,
where it's one of those things where there's like sins that you've been working to overcome, like your entire life. And the grace of confession, like they're gone. Like, so.
Yeah. Was the view that you came from in the sort of the Baptist PCA background, the view of justification and sanctification and sort of like the journey with sin and stuff?
So I think I actually had a very Catholic like soteriology before, because I remember even in high school, like when, like in that senior year class, that made a lot of sense. The teacher being like, hey, people talk about like, are you saved by faith and works? And he's like, you know what? You're saved by grace. And if you're saved by grace, faith, works, they come together. Like you can't separate faith, hope, and love.
Right.
And so even like the idea of being saved, like faith alone, like I believe, like as a Protestant, I was saved by faith, hope, and love. Mm-hmm. And how that exactly, like, so the justification was not a huge change. What was the big change? And actually, and this is where that I struggled with, that it was that Scott Hahn unlocked, was when I came across the idea of like baptism actually washing away original sin,
okay,
and the sacraments doing the very things they represent. Mm-hmm. Like that, is, and in many ways, that's like the crux of the entire Reformation, yeah, is that issue.
Right.
Like, does baptism actually like restore our relationship with God? Mm-hmm. And you're like, yes, concupiscence remains, but if it does, then sanctification becomes possible.
Right.
So that was the intellectual question that, along with the authority, that was the biggest struggle. And then that's when Scott Hahn unlocked, like, no, like, not only does it make sense if it does that, it makes everything make sense. Mm-hmm. It makes the entire scriptures make sense. It makes salvation history make sense. Yeah. Like, how you live as a Christian, like, it all just makes sense, like, at that point. So,
and it's a counter to the accusation that Catholics are our works righteousness, because we don't do much in the sacraments. Like, we show up and God does. He works. He, you know, it's His grace working in the sacraments. Now, we respond to that, right? We go, we try to take that grace and do what He bids us to do. But it begins and ends with His grace, right? And the sacraments are the greatest example of that. We're not doing something. We're showing up and allowing it to happen to us. We're saying yes to God, but He's working in the sacraments.
Yeah. And the fact He lets us participate, knowing that all we don't add anything, we just screw it up. And this is always the analogy I always use in RCIA was, it's like the adult helping, letting the child help make the cookies.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
They never improve the cookies.
Right.
But.
Yeah, I love that. I love that analogy as well, because partially because again, it's such a real image that, you know, God knows we're going to mess this up, but He wants us to be part of it. Like, He's a good father in that sense of like, yes, He could probably, you know, rake the yard faster, but He wants His kids to take part in His work because they're changed by that process, right? When we obey God, when we participate with Him in obedience, right? He's changing us through the experience. And so, yeah, He knows He could, if it's just a matter of getting His work done, He could snap His fingers and do it, right? Evangelizing the world or doing this, that, and the other. But He wants us to participate in it because that's how we're changed.
Yeah, exactly. The fact He wanted apostles, knowing that the only what's the phrase that the first thing they ever agreed upon was to abandon Jesus on the cross, like that.
Yeah,
knowing that they're not going to improve anything He's doing, but that's what He uses.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was the key, the linchpin was the sacramentality.
All right.
And so anyway, so it was December 8th, 2004, ended up becoming Catholic, and it was one of those things where, when over time, when you look back at it, it's like, well, people are like, why did you become Catholic? Why did you become Catholic? Because that becomes the question that they always hit. And it's like, well, the first answer was, well, I became convinced that the Catholic Church was the church that Jesus founded. And I had like a long answer.
Yeah.
And then it was finally, it was after a few years, it's like, well, I just became convinced that this is the best way that I could possibly have the deepest possible relationship with Jesus Christ and get to heaven. And it's true. Like, so.
Yeah, I think it isn't like Chesterton's, you know, answer. It's like, well, there's a thousand answers, right? But they all amount to that one. That's just, this is, it's true. And it's the best way to get to Jesus. Well, that's amazing. What happened after that, if you became Catholic in your life?
I started dating my then girlfriend immediately after, who was Catholic. Okay. I started dating her when I came back after my freshman year, and I told her, like, I emailed her, et cetera, and I'm like, hey, I'm becoming a Catholic. And so people always ask, like, oh, did you become Catholic for your group? And I'm like, no, I was becoming Catholic first. but then, anyway, so, and just dove in with, like, both feet. And it was, like, So I went through, ended up studying history, but then ended up getting married. We actually now have six children. Then I taught in Catholic schools for 5 years, did a master's in theology, worked at parish as pastoral associate for 10 years. And it was one of those things where it just changes the entire course of your life, where like not only how you like what you do on Sunday, but how you think about everything, everything you read, every decision you make with your children, like how you want to raise them. And then that's even a portion of it where you think about is like, as you're going through all of this, is like, well, what is it you want to pass on to kids that you don't have at the time? And so when you see, and this is actually a part I didn't mention, was you see Catholic families. And so in this particularly, there are young Catholic families who are professors in college, and seeing their family life, which I had a great family life, but there was something there that I'm like, that's what I want to pass on. I want to have a family life and children that are reflecting that. So I got very close with a few of them.
That was really one of my questions, is that you had such a great Christian family experience. And so what are some of the aspects of now of being Catholic that you've added to that in terms of how you raise your family?
I mean, the portion especially is, I mean, there's the deeply involved in sacraments. I mean, my third son just started altar serving. And I mean, it's the most important thing literally in his entire life right now. But it affects everything from like the entire, like we homeschool our younger kids, our older ones are in classical Catholic high school, but the entirety of how you understand education, like everything like revolves around this. Like the entire liturgical year. I mean, this is something that's mind blowing when you're Catholic and experience, or you become Catholic and experience your first Triduum in Easter. And like, well, I mean, we had a ham on like Sundays as a child and or on Easter Sunday, but it was not this immersive, totally in like intensive thing where it's like affects your entire life, where you dive in. Like, I think we had in high school, maybe like get encouraged to give something up for Lent once. Cause it's like, it's kind of an, but I'm like, what's Lent? Like, I didn't know, but like, oh, you're diving into this, like with both feet. And then you're living through the entire Triduum and the entire like passion and death of like Jesus. And then you're really celebrating on Easter Sunday and like living this liturgy within everything. And then, like I said, and seeing it within these Catholic families that I became close with. So I ended up actually one of them, Brad Berger, he became my sponsor when I did, and like was very close with their family. And it was, and Steve Smith was another one. And it is, I mean, it just,
that's incredible.
Changes everything.
I love the point though about the liturgical year. Like the, again, it's that sacramental worldview, the church gives us, invites us, you know, to sanctify our time in so many important ways on the macro level in terms of the year, but even on the micro level in terms of like the liturgy, the hours. Right, this seeing our time as something to be taken hold of and embraced and ordered and brought into our Christian life, all of it, not just like certain times, but all of it, it has this sanctifying quality to it.
Yeah, and the fact you don't have to reinvent the wheel was another huge portion, because so much of spirituality growing up was like, oh, I have this new great idea. And you come up with, I would say, as you go through becoming Catholic and you dive into these things, you're like, oh, actually people already thought through all these things. So it's like, okay, how do you make sure that you're grounded in scripture every day? How do you make sure that you're in the Psalms, the church fathers? And like, oh, the liturgy of the hours. Like, I mean, it's already been sort of thought through, like that there was part of that richness.
That's a good point. Like we tend to think of the history, the historical, the traditional element in terms of the doctrines. But there's this a great accumulation led by the Spirit of, you know, the wisdom of the saints, the wisdom of the devotional practices and the prayers. You know, like I've just been thinking lately about the great blessing it is to have Catholic prayers. I've had this black Catholic prayer book since confirmation. And for many years, I just kind of carried it around with me. I'm like, what do I do with this? Like, I'll open it up if I need to look up something. But it's only been recent years. I'm like, oh, I understand why I see like these older Catholics walking around with this worn out prayer book, because it's like, when I don't know what to pray, I have a treasury of these great treasures from saints and doctors of the church for 2,000 years.
No, right? Exactly. And that was a big thing, is I remember actually one of those professors giving me a copy of the Opus Dei, like Handbook of Prayers.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I mean, I think I've gone through like 10 of them as it's been worn down like time and again. But it was like, oh, I'm not going to just sit and just emote at Jesus. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the brain isn't working.
Right.
And be able to like, all right, before Mass, like I'm going to read Thomas Aquinas' like prayer before Mass. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you're sitting and praying in church. It's like, let's do the Stations of the Cross. Like, I mean, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And it actually actively engages the intellect in a way where like, oh, actually now I can pray. Like, I mean, it's the old difference between meditation and contemplation, or like meditation, you're engaging the intellect and it starts with like thinking about different things in the life of Christ. And then sometimes God will give like that moment of grace where, that comes after it, but not usually. Like the work we do is the meditation, the act of thinking portion. But bringing back the Catherine of Siena, like actually I would say the one contemplative experience I've had in my entire life, everything was when shortly after my wife and I married, my brother who had converted, he was doing the Master's of Architecture program at Notre Dame. And so he was over in Rome for a semester. So we went to go over and visit. And so anyway, but praying at the tomb of Catherine of Siena was like, literally, I was going to say every once in a while, people will have one of those indescribable contemplative experiences. Right. And that was the one I've ever had. So I'm like, okay, I think you were involved in that journey. Like, so
that's awesome. We've got about 8 minutes left. Can you tell us a bit more about how did the Evangelical Catholicism project or apostolate come about? How did that happen?
Yeah, so this came from Father J. Scott Newman, who George Weigel's written about him a couple of times in like Letters to a Young Catholic is one example. Okay. And so he is the pastor of our parish. And so I was teaching in Catholic high school at the time. I walk out of Mass and he's like, hey, can I stop you for a second? And it was, anyway, he's like, hey, you want to come work for me? I mean, more or less, he's like, and we're going to start a nonprofit together. And I'm like, okay. And so I didn't know exactly what it was, but the idea was, he wanted to try to like help other parishes that were doing what he was doing, because there people keep asking about it. Mm-hmm. And actually where that idea came from was once again, was actually from Scott Hahn, who told him, hey, you need to do this. So like, okay, let's start it.
Yeah.
What are we going to do? And so it was like, I don't know. Like, and so it was literally like start from scratch. Like, what do we do? So it was like, okay, I guess make a website and then it's real. So made a website, but then it was like, okay, let's think through like the truth, goodness, and beauty aspect. Mm-hmm. Like those are what convert. We're trying to evangelize within the church. Mm-hmm. We'll start with the beauty aspect. So one of the things that's not unique to St. Mary's, but is very rare is that he says the Mass there is it's a Novus Ordo liturgy, but it's as beautiful as it could possibly be.
Yeah.
And the preaching is phenomenal every week. Mm-hmm. And people literally move from the entire country to go there. And I was going to say, National Catholic Register wrote an article on that recently. And the people move. I mean, it's not actually, there's three different parishes in Greenville where it's the same way. And anyway, so it was like, all right, let's help young priests that they want to do this, but also they don't want to like come across with a heavy hand where they want people to feel like, hey, we're doing this together, like within the parish. Like this is the direction we're all going together. It's not just new priests coming in and like, oh, we're going to change things. It's like, no, let's. Like we're moving together towards Christ.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's a, like, let's start mentoring and like helping with that aspect.
That's great.
But then it's like, okay, let's look wherever there's gaps in the church. Like there was great intellectual content. So let's move on and start like, well, how do we help people with the goodness portion? So start anyway. So it sort of one thing after another, in that aspect, but the idea of just ultimately evangelizing within the church.
Yeah.
Not outside the church, in the church.
Right.
Make more Catholics into committed Christians.
Yes.
Not just cultural Catholics.
Oh, that's excellent. What a great mission. All right. Well, you know, if there's so many things we could talk about, but, you know, with the few minutes we have left, again, thinking about somebody who's maybe coming from a similar background to you, you know, wrestling with some of these questions that you mentioned early on in terms of, again, authority, maybe the worship question. Right? Where does that person, where would they, you suggest they start in terms of this journey of exploration to answer their questions?
I'd say the first place is starting with prayer. Mm-hmm. Like deeply, like openly asking of like, God, like, if this is something you want me to know and do, like change my heart. Because he does, like yeah. every time he does when yeah. that's the case. But then two, like, I mean, start with actually understanding a little bit of church history, understanding, like, cause that was the one, like, domino ultimately had to fall was the idea of sola scriptura. Yeah. Like, there's no infallible index, like, in the Bible. Like, if we're going to trust the Bible, I ultimately trust it because the church gave it to me.
And the historical element is so important there. In other words, there's the inner logic of these issues,
yeah.
but the historical perspective is so necessary
yeah.
as a Christian.
Because it was, even every one of the other issues after that, mm-hmm. like, I just realized, like, they're just intellectual hangups because, and ultimately out of pride, it was like, well, I'm not the arbiter of truth. Mm-hmm. Like, why do I have to give my stamp of approval to, like, Marian theology? Why do I have to give my stamp of, because ultimately then I'm becoming the ultimate authority of everything.
Right, right.
And there's, and they're like, okay, like, to a certain degree, at some point you have to humble yourself and be like, this isn't an intellectual cop-out. It's actually a humbling of knowing that, like, there's other authorities that I'm just going to trust.
Yeah, yeah. And so. greater understanding can come after that trust, right?
Yeah.
Seeking understanding. But again, I always think too, with regards to that perspective on like, how does authority work? How does, you know, how do we come to know truth as Christians? Again, if it's not the case that at some point I can trust the Holy Spirit guiding the church and then continue to learn after that. Again, it leaves a lot of people out because not everybody can be, you know, an intellectual reading a bunch of books. A lot of people yeah. throughout history, right?
No, exactly.
And so, you know, it's a model for coming to the truth that is open to everybody, right?
Yeah, it's not just a faith for the strong or in the intellectual.
Yeah,
exactly.
I was thinking earlier, I was chuckling because you know, when you first dove into the historical perspective, you know, the first topic that kind of sparked your interest was the Arian heresy, which is not what people don't really think of, right?
That's yeah.
But I think it's an interesting point that when you look in the early church, right, the things that they argued about are the things that for almost all modern Christians are settled. And the things that are, you know, disagreed upon amongst modern Christians, you look back in the early church, they were never questioned.
Yeah.
Right? In the early church, they weren't questioning the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Right, that was sort of taken as a given amongst the early Christians.
Yeah, but they're arguing about the Trinity.
Right.
Yeah.
Those things that now are settled. And so there's always that, again, you dig into that and you realize already I'm accepting the authority of the church because I'm accepting these things that were argued about and then settled
yeah.
in the church. Yeah.
So, and even all those touch points, I realize that they've sort of made their ways into the names of my children.
Yeah.
So, like, our oldest son was John Paul. So, with reading with the Witness to Hope in there. I have one daughter whose middle name's Catherine because of that. But then I have our second son, his name's Henry, for John Henry Newman, who was, I didn't talk a lot about, but that was a huge portion of reading him throughout all of this.
Yeah.
And then his middle name is Athanasius because he was the one arguing against the Arian heresy. And I think he had a role in there too. So
that's amazing. Yeah. Truth, goodness, and beauty. I really like how you shared that as part of your story. And that's what we would propose that people would find in the church. I mean, certainly the truth, certainly that if you ask these hard questions of the church, like, we think you'll get answers, but, gosh, there's really no greater evangelization than when you meet the saints, whether in real life or in literature, when you encounter them, you recognize something real has happened here in this person's life. And, yeah, it's an incredible thing. I love the work that you guys are doing and I will be praying for it.
Thanks.
TJ, thanks for sharing your story with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Praying for your work. Again, that website is evangelicalcatholicism.com, and the podcast, is that probably on YouTube and different podcast services?
It's on iTunes and SoundCloud and Spotify.
All right. The Boneyard.
Bone Church Revival.
BoneChurchRevival.com. Such an awesome, epic
yeah.
title for a podcast there. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that TJ's story is an inspiration to you. Again, check out his website, evangelicalcatholicism.com. And I want to remind you, as always, that, again, we share these stories, but they're a great reminder both of what, you know, the truth of the church, the goodness and the beauty to be found there, but a reminder that you and I are remain on a journey, right? God's not done with us this side of heaven. We remain pilgrims on that journey. and we have to keep taking one step at a time. So let's pray for each other, but we'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless.